speakers.
This is our September meeting. We meet on the third Wednesday of every month. And today we're going to be hearing from John on spiritual naturalism. Thank you. But before that, there's just a couple of matters that I wanted to take care of. And they have to do with who wants to chair this organization next year, and also how we're going to finish up the year. We have three more months left in this year, October, November, and December. And right now we have no speakers at all. Okay, that's not a terrible problem, because I discovered that it's not that hard to just find an article and make it a topic. And I have a few articles like that to get us through to the end of the year. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Glenn.
So I have a couple such articles, and if necessary, I can do all 3 months. But this will be the end of, that'll take us to the end of the year, and then we'll need somebody to chair this organization. Is anybody interested in doing that?
I wouldn't mind doing it, but, you know, I just can't do it. My
okay.
Night is won't let me.
How about you, Philip? Are you interested?
I'm too bored in soccer. I teach Spanish. I just.
I think John's not here enough to. You're probably not that interested in the group anymore.
Not enough to chair it. No.
Okay, Henry.
No, thank you.
Okay, well, I could turn to Chad again, but he's done it a couple years in a row. Are you interested in doing it again next year?
No.
Okay, well, we may just find out that there isn't enough interest in this group for it to continue. And, well,
yeah.
Okay, I don't have speakers, and I don't have anyone to chair the organization.
Well, I'm not for 3 months
and
now,
if there's,
next week.
And, you know, sometimes something plays itself out, and it's just time to put it to bed.
When does your term run out?
The end of the year.
You didn't sign up for 2 years?
No.
I did 2 years.
Here.
I thought that it was always for 4 years, huh?
Yeah, it should be four.
And then you're re-elected. What does being chair involve? What do you have to do?
Are you interested, Penny?
What does being chair involve?
Well, every month you place an ad in the Guadalajara Reporter, you make an announcement to the membership, those are email, you reserve this room from Michael Eager, and... When you either make the presentation yourself or find someone else to do it. What do you think?
Well, I'm just curious because I'm new to the group.
Okay.
Why
well,
nobody will do it.
It's such
a hard job.
Hey, David. Mm-hmm. I didn't think you'd be interested in doing it before your first meeting. But,
well, I'm leaving the country then.
That's right. You said that. Okay. Oh, I thought you were moving.
I'm just going to Canada for 8 months.
Okay. Anyway. What do we think about this idea? Now, when I say disband, we don't have to disband the Lakeside Freethinkers, but we might have to give up the meetings.
Yeah.
There can still be an email list and email discussions if there's any interest.
Yeah, and we can always meet at people's homes, I mean, informally, here and there, whenever, you know.
Always for.
I think.
Please speak up.
Well, what we're talking about now, David, is two issues. One is I guess the matter of not having speakers is not that important for the rest of this year, but it's going to be a problem that's going to continue on year after year after year. There just isn't that much interest in people coming here and giving a presentation 12 times a year. And the other problem is nobody wants to chair the group either. What I'm discussing right now is the possibility of just disbanding this, which might sound
harsh,
extreme, but what else are you going to do? Well, what's going to happen in January? No chair and no speaker.
I've been there before, and it's happened.
Any ideas?
Where's the chairman's Christmas party going to be?
There's not going to be a chairman's Christmas party.
There has been for 3 years.
Good ones, too.
Good ones.
Yeah, nice parties. But if you want to host another party, you're welcome to, but I wasn't planning on doing that.
We could talk.
Okay.
I like to have a party.
Anyway, here's the situation. If nothing changes between now and the end of the year, we're done. Come 2018. Because there's going to be nobody to do it.
I'd encourage you to send out inquiries to everybody, to individuals.
I've done that. I've done that.
I didn't get one.
I sent out a general email to the membership asking for anybody that had ideas on things they wanted to present, and I got not a single answer.
I know.
Okay.
When did you do that?
Probably about 6 months ago, I'm guessing.
No, I was thinking more of the chairmanship to keep it going.
I really don't want to beat the bushes looking for somebody. First of all, who's going to want to do it that isn't a regular attendee? We're going to get somebody that's on an email list that's never come to a meeting wanting to be chair. I don't think that's going to happen. And I really don't want to start emailing people one at a time saying, will you do it, will you do it, will you do it? I'd be happy to send out one email to the whole membership saying we're looking for a chair.
I would encourage you to do a couple of those anyway, just see if you get anything.
I don't think it's necessary to do more than one.
Well, you send it to him, he won't get it.
I think my situation is not unique. That's the thing. You know, anybody who's had an email address any length of time is just being inundated.
I look at every email I get.
I do too. And I do have over, 120 or 30 unread, but I look.
And I also look at the title, the subject of everyone that goes directly to spam. Because every once in a while there's one in there.
Yes,
I want.
That's true. That's true.
But yeah. The thing is, only about maybe 40 show up on the screen. Mm-hmm. And so then you have to scroll down. And like I said, I get about 200, if not 300 a day. I mean, so that is... That it will be about maybe 8 screens. I haven't got the time for that.
I don't know how that happened to you.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know either, but it just developed that way.
Like establish a new email.
I've tried every which way, and
well,
if you get
a new email address, then you start fresh.
Yeah, that's the only way, yeah.
But right now, you're not really part of the email community. You're not.
No.
It's like not having it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ken Crosby's once in a while on mine went to spam. I was surprised. No.
If we give up these meetings, Ken Crosby's emails will be all of the Lakeside Freethinkers. Because there's really not much in the way of discussions going on anymore. There were 2 or 3 years ago. We had, like the one you were talking about with free will. We had nice running discussions, a variety of topics. We would communicate among each other. That just doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. And right now, the whole of Lakeside Freethinkers, as far as I know, is the odd email from Ken Crosby in Texas and these meetings. And these meetings are... on life support. Anyway, I'm just letting everybody know because if nothing changes, I will send out one email soliciting a chair, but not over and over. I wouldn't want to get that email over and over. I'll send it out once, and if nothing comes from that, it looks like we're done. Yes?
How is this room paid for?
Only by the 80 pesos that we've agreed to spend.
Oh, I see.
Were you aware of that?
Okay. Yeah, just paid your
okay.
So in theory, you don't need to worry about it. If everybody knows that the meeting is the third
Wednesday
of the month,
yeah,
have a whole bunch of topics that people can prepare.
Would you like to prepare those for us?
Well, I will when I come back.
That's the problem. We don't have a whole bunch of topics.
The thing is that the group doesn't compare to mindfulness, but in a way it does. I was amazed in mindfulness class.
At what?
Mindfulness class.
Okay.
And they follow a book. I don't go anymore because I've done the book and I don't want to go back. But every week, they're there and people show up. Sometimes there are 2 and sometimes there's 15.
Mm-hmm.
But it always seems to work. And we discuss the topic and we go off topic and, discuss interesting things. It doesn't seem to take much organization. It takes one person to put the email... topic that we think we might discuss, and that's it. As far as I know, that's all they have to do. We just show up.
Yes, Bobby?
There is a Free Thinkers magazine, is that true?
Skeptical Inquiry, is that what you mean?
Sorry, I know there is, because Bill showed us the magazine.
Skeptical Inquiry, it's from...
Skeptical Inquiry.
Yeah.
Are there not articles in there that does everybody subscribe to?
I don't subscribe to it. I used to in the past, but not now. I don't subscribe to any magazines anymore.
Idea was that if everyone here, I would think, would subscribe to that, choose an article, and that's what you discuss, the article on the Free Thinkers. Expand on it, think about it. What about that? It's like any book club, you have something to talk about. And people, if you're interested enough to come here, you should all be interested in reading more about it.
Well, finding topics is not a real problem. It's just a matter of sitting down and turning on your computer. And then,
but don't you think some preparation has to be made? You can't just put out a topic.
No, ideally, yes. But I mean, if it's just a topic, you know, and then oftentimes articles, when particularly when they're scholarly, they have an abstract, and that's all you need really to share it with others as a basis for talking about it. But ideally, you would have somebody who's someone who's prepared that makes it more interesting.
You know, I think the point is though, you don't have to have a presenter.
No, right.
If you have a topic, and people know what the topic is, mostly they will do a little reading about it, maybe, and if they don't, that's okay too. But still, you need a chairman to coordinate this.
Chairman, you need somebody to.
Well, that's essentially the chairman.
It could be a chairwoman too.
The other point is that
our chairperson.
David.
The other point is that I don't want to say this.
Hang on a minute, David.
I don't know if this is preached to the choir, but everybody here is at least approaches things with an open mind about the topics, and it might be interesting to have some debates with people who might choose the opposite way of thinking, and without enveloping them, permitting them to have their say-so.
You're probably talking about religious topics.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, it'd be political as well. It could be religious, political, scientific.
Well, that brings us to another area, like what kind of topics are appropriate. Early in the year, I sent out an email asking for opinions on that. Really isn't a lot to talk about if the subject is atheism. Because atheism is a very short subject. You just...
You read our name.
Almost a word long.
You are the name.
It's a sentence, and it's over. So it has to be something more positive than that. It has to be something like anti-theism, or secular humanism, or Christianity, or Islam, or something like that. It just can't be atheism. I don't think we really want to talk about the other religions. That could be a topic for discussion.
What about one of God, Plato's dialogues?
Well, that's the second category, just philosophy in general. And the third one is science.
Yeah, right.
So,
morality.
Well, that comes
with ethics.
That's actually on my short list of topics. I wanted to discuss this with what we might want to do in the coming months, but I'll wait a second until... Did you have more to say, Valerie?
No, it's just that the Plato dialogues are easy reading and short and, you know, promote a lot of conversation.
But still, doesn't that take somebody that's fairly familiar with Plato and fairly convert?
I'll do that if I get back in the first of the year.
Okay, but that's just one idea, and that's 1 month. But thank you for volunteering for that, I'm sure.
If they kick me out of Spain, then I'll be back.
We'll get to your talk in just a second.
No problem, go ahead.
My short list here of things to talk about. Number one, as Amy mentioned, I don't know if this is really appropriate for free thinkers, but I've been doing a lot of investigating lately on the motions of the Earth, daily motions, yearly motions, and its relationship to calendars, which I think is an interesting subject, but I don't know if anybody in this room wants to hear about that. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. I could present that in December, and actually our last meeting will come the day before the winter solstice, so it might be... A nice thing to discuss on December 20th, which is like this month, the 20th will be the third Wednesday in December. But I just don't know if that's appropriate. These are the free thinkers. Do people here want to hear about precession of the Earth and the Julian calendar? I don't know.
Well, and the other guy.
Yes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Can you explain the analemma?
I know what it is. Anyway, that would be one thing. Here are the other topics that I came up with, because there's a real nice article that's several years old now. It's called What It's Like to Be a Bat. Anybody ever heard of that?
Oh, yes.
It's an interesting subject, because basically it's talking about what it's like.
Thomas Nagel?
Yeah. Very good. What it would be like, if you didn't have vision, instead you saw the world through echolocation. Well, what would it be like to be in a mind like that? And it's a doorway into the topic of other minds, which we brushed on briefly last month when we were talking about artificial intelligence. I mean, I know you're conscious because I know you came into the world the way I did. And you're made out of what I'm made out of. And so I know you're like me. But what if you were a machine?
Yeah.
And what if there was a machine that exactly imitated Valerie?
Turing? It scared the hell out of everybody.
Well, no, my question is, is there any way I would be able to tell whether you're conscious or whether that machine was conscious or whether it just was doing a perfect imitation of consciousness? Was that thing self-aware? We could never answer that question, could we? So that's a kind of interesting philosophical discussion.
May I comment?
Yes.
That's the kind of topic I would come out for. And there is lots of scope for discussion. This article was written in the 1970s.
Very old, yeah.
And is still discussed today intensely. And there is a real divide in the philosophical community of those who think that Thomas Nagel is correct in his views and those who disagree with his views. It becomes very interesting discussion, and it ties into so many unresolved things. So
then we'll make that a topic for one of the last 3 months.
That's another thing. How about just taking some great thinkers in history and up to now and
We don't have a shortage of topics. What we have is a shortage of people willing to organize a discussion around that topic.
Well, you have to ask for volunteers for that.
Yeah, and I've been doing it all year and not finding them.
That's what we're talking about.
Also, I think this venue, frankly, is... I mean, I don't mind the fact that we... but this long rectangular table does not. I'm an old school teacher, and we would never discuss things.
It's very difficult to find good meeting rooms in Lakeside.
How about people's homes? Well, is that impossible? You have a home where there are 12 people once a year?
Well, it's difficult with the number of people, and we didn't know exactly how many would come, you know?
And there's also not a lot of volunteerism here. So, I just don't think that's going to happen. We have a block party on our block. All the people live in our neighborhood. The first Friday of every month. It's becoming very, very difficult to find people to host it.
Really? Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. There's just not... There's the interest in coming, but not the interest in hosting. So I think we have some of the same issues here. There's the interest in coming, not the interest in presenting. Okay, so other minds will be one topic. Another one that's kind of interesting. There's an article I read some time ago from a geologist who used to be a young earth creationist. You know what I mean by that? Somebody believes the earth is about 6,000 years old.
Right.
There is another group called the old earth creationists. They still believe in creation, but they think the earth is what the scientists say, billions of years old. And this guy, his name is Glenn Morton, he went from being a young earth creationist to from a young earth to an old earth. In his study in geology, he studied earth. And in the process, he decided that the Bible must be wrong. And he wrote an article called Morton's Demon. And what he's done is he's anthropomorphizing a confirmation bias. A confirmation bias is like something that happens to some people when they develop a faith-based belief. And suddenly, this thing forms around their head that filters what's coming into the head. And anything that supports the bias is allowed in, and anything that doesn't support the bias can't be seen. It's not just simply rejected. It's like these, I don't know if you're familiar, if you've dealt with the creationists on the internet, I do a lot. But they go, where's the evidence for evolution? You show it to them, they go, that's not evidence. I mean, how are you going to reach that person? Okay, but so he talks about Morton's Demon, and if you're familiar with James Clerk Maxwell, he was a physicist from the late 19th century, and he coined Maxwell's demon. And Maxwell's demon was an imaginary little demon that sat in a portal between two chambers, and he let all the fast-moving molecules go one way and all the slow-moving molecules go the other way. And as a result, a spontaneously evenly heated partition chamber became a cold one and a hot one, which is a violation of thermodynamics. But he said if there was really a little thing down there doing that, that could happen. And so Morton made his own demon. He said, when I was a young earth creationist, there was something sitting in my head. He goes, when I tell you that I didn't see something, I'm not lying. I just could not see it. And I thought that was fascinating. I believed him. And so now I deal with these people on the internet all the time, and other people go, you're a liar. You're deceitful. You're dishonest. And I'm saying, no, Morton says they just can't see what you see. And it's an interesting discussion.
That's very true, because I have a theory that I teach at the High Museum of Art to high schoolers. And I say to them in the very beginning, there is an old adage that says, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. That's not true. The adage really is, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it.
It's well said, Mallory. It's exactly right. So, and a third topic that I thought might be interesting to discuss, we only have time for three, and I think if the calendars one is one you want to hear, then that'll be one of them. Another one was basically intelligent design. Tyson, Neil deGrasse Tyson, has done a nice video called Stupid Design. It's really just a counter-argument. He goes, an intelligent designer wouldn't have done this, wouldn't have done this, wouldn't have done this, wouldn't have done this. And with that, we can talk about the famous trials about intelligent design. You may know about them. There was, most recently, was the Kitzmiller trial in Dover, Pennsylvania, where they declared that intelligent design was religion and that it was pseudoscience and it doesn't belong in the public schools. That might be a topic. And then lastly, what David was suggesting, I have a nice article on the biological basis of morality. I could just send out a link on that and we could take off from there. So those would all be fairly easy things to present except for the calendars one. That one I'm going to have to do some work on, but I'm happy to do that because I'm doing that anyway whether we want to hear it or not. Okay, so we'll have to see how this goes. Like I said, right now I think we're getting close to stalling. I don't really want to do this a second year. It's nobody else wants to, huh?
Well, it sounds. Why don't we consider having like a rotating chair, where there's plenty of topics that one person could, you know, implement on a rotating basis. I mean, you know, if you guys want to do something like duplicating spheres, I'm always into doing something like that.
The volume of two spheres compared to one? That one?
Well, like I did before, but yeah, yeah. I mean, a topic similar to that.
Okay.
There's an interesting mathematical topic on big numbers. I mean, you know.
Transfinite. Transfinite numbers.
Just ridiculously big numbers.
Okay.
I gave a presentation a couple of years ago on big numbers. It's a fascinating topic.
With the arrows?
Yeah, but...
Yeah. Anyway,
just how you can do how big numbers are different than
well, there's something called the busy beaver problem, which is I think very interesting, where the numbers it's how big numbers get when you have Turing machines. Anyway, it would be interesting, but it's mathematically oriented, so I would be happy to do one month like that, and if we rotate it around with things that people are themselves interested in, then I think you maybe can distribute the load.
I would volunteer for 1 month.
Right.
So. Okay. Another possibility is Henry and I belong to Cosmology Club. It only meets quarterly. Every 3 months we get together. In fact, we were supposed to meet today, but he moved it up a week.
Right.
And so we'll be meeting next Wednesday here. But. That would be another way to do this. If it was every 3 months, there'd only be 4 meetings a year.
Well, you could do it the distributed way, and then if there's a month where nobody steps forward, you skip a month until somebody does step forward.
We started out the year that way. I think I canceled the February meeting because I didn't have a speaker. Then Chad pointed out to me the bylaws don't allow me to do that.
Well, those could be more flexible.
Go by the law.
I don't think there's a bylaws police to enforce them. Anyway, all right. Well, I don't want to take up any more of John's time.
Well, but I just say, if we want to compile a list of topics, I don't mind being the repository for that, sorting through them. You know, if everyone wants to send ideas, you know, if we can come up with at least 12. Mm-hmm. And then... Mm-hmm. You know, it can be, you know, self-generated.
But I just want to say that I don't think lack of ideas is the issue. Chad just showed me a whole list of ideas.
But if we have ideas and they've sort of, I mean, I don't mind chairing the meeting. It's the Guadalajara report. It's the email management. It's the, you know.
That's second.
Oh, in favor, say aye.
You're sliding in the right direction. Well, for it, yeah.
And where's the Christmas party going?
But, it's all sort of things, you know. But as far as my, you know, taking it over with my presence, that's no problem.
We could have the Christmas party at my house.
You want to do it?
But, yeah. Sure. You know, if someone wanted to do the Guadalajara report, the email.
You know what? I can do that for you.
Mike, whatever.
If you'll be the chair.
I'm being the chair.
I'll take care of all the emails.
Okay. I'm being the chair means.
Being here, picking topics.
Hold her
doing what I'm doing right now.
Okay. All the visible stuff you do.
The only invisible stuff I do is send out those emails and maybe prepare for talks.
Well, if everyone can, I mean, everyone had ideas for topics. If everyone can send me, preiler@msn.com, it's on the, you know, find on the list.
And when you say topic, it doesn't mean that you need to give a big presentation.
No. Okay. Just an idea. And it'd be nice to say why you think this is appropriate for three things.
I think somebody should do some looking into it and be prepared to discuss something about it. I don't really envision just saying, here's the topic, and then who wants to put up a hand?
I mean, whoever has a topic, certainly they should be interested in it and know something about it.
And say something to start the conversation. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be half an hour. It can be 10 minutes or 5 minutes. But
if it's possible that the article or whatever the idea is can be put on the computer, you know, for everybody to be able to peruse.
Suggest where to find it.
Well, that's what we did last month.
I'll just use the therapist style, which is, you know, everything everyone says, just answer with, why do you think that?
Just let it go on.
How many meetings are you in?
So are you agreeing to do this?
I'll do the visible part. If you can take over the emails, the Guadalajara Reporter, deal with Mike.
That's just the three emails every month that I send out.
Yeah?
Actually, two to the membership, so it ends up being four. That's not hard to do.
I don't mind sitting here and challenging people with something.
Do you want to be in charge of collecting ideas and choosing the topic?
Well, I'm hoping that people send it, but if we're short, I'll certainly...
Chad, you still got that list? It looks like it's right there on the top.
Yeah.
That's take a look at this, Phil. There's several lists like this.
Oh, yeah.
He highlighted the ones that I put stars by the ones I thought were pretty interesting.
Science and religion, enemy or strangers?
Yeah, so what's wrong with this list?
There's nothing wrong with this list, but I've been saying all along there's no shortage of topics.
Free thought.
The problem is elsewhere.
I'll send it.
Yeah, if you will. For the crash.
Looks like you're still stuck with something, though.
I'll do that a little bit.
You don't mind that?
No.
You're going to be the vice chair?
I guess I will be.
That's the progression. You're going to stay as second.
Yeah, I'll still bring my iPhone.
Well, that's all you need to do.
Okay.
Although there is, I'll send Phil some stuff about, that would be the executive committee, and there are some things that you can do, whether the members like it or not, kind of an attitude.
So you are going to be the secretary or not?
Sure, yeah. Ken likes my iPhone.
He does.
Audio stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll keep him happy.
It's a nice service. All right, I think it's time to get to John, and he's going to tell us what spiritual naturalism is.
Thank you, Stephen. I was curious how many would turn out. Group 12 is worthwhile.
So I'm pleased with the turnout. Where I would like to start this presentation is to do a little survey of this group, just to understand the group here a little better. I'm going to pose some questions to help sort the group into Group A and Group B. And there are no right or wrong answers. These are preferences, no right or wrong answers, but it will give me a sense of this group and how it might relate to the topic. So to illustrate, in the academic world, there is tension between the sciences and the humanities. There are people who prefer the sciences, there are people who prefer the humanities. There's no right or wrong. There are people who think one is more important than the other. So that is the kind of divide I'm talking about. From my perspective, there's no right or wrong. We need both science and we need the humanities. So Group A, these would be people who prefer the sciences, prefer to self-identify as an atheism, put an emphasis on empirical evidence, put an emphasis on reason, on facts, dealing with what is known. So some general characteristics of Group A. Group B might have the following characteristics: a preference for the humanities more so than sciences, a preference to self-identify as a secular humanist rather than self-identify as an atheist, put quite a high value on lived experience, put a value on values, science dealing with facts, the humanities more with values, and exploring the unknown. So again, just a rough feel for who is most comfortable in Group A and who is most comfortable in Group A, Group B. So Group A people. Show of hands.
But I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
When you say humanities, are you talking about the social sciences? Like history and economics? And
I'm trying not to be that precise because, okay. I mean the definitions the way they're used in the academic world.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't see your descriptions being very, very mutually exclusive.
But that's a good point. They are not mutually exclusive. There's all kinds of overlaps. Uh-huh. These are continuums, not discrete categories. So it's just, where do you feel most comfortable? That's all I'm okay. looking for. Okay. Not for precise, exact. It's just a rough, where do you feel most comfortable, Group A or Group B? What resonates with you? Group A people?
Is that the humanities?
No.
Science.
More of the higher sciences.
And Group B people? Interesting. 50, so 50, right? Almost 50-50, yes?
How about if you're in A, but you feel guilty about not being more over in B?
You have to decide.
I would say that is reflective. No, that I like that. That's open-minded.
Okay. Yeah.
Another question.
Sure.
I identify with being trained more in Group A, but I value Group B more.
Interesting.
What's your training?
I've got a bachelor's in economics, so I have a master's in computer science, and I have all but a thesis for a master's in social work.
Okay.
I have industrial engineering and mathematical statistics.
Yeah. And there can be quite a big difference between who we are in a work setting and who we are in a personal setting. Sure.
Why don't you just do a gut feeling? What?
Yeah, that's all I was looking for. We have the answer. It's roughly 50-50. That's just an indication, which is good. That might lead to some good discussion. Okay, I want to, some of this is just overview. I want to talk about worldviews for a moment, and I'll talk about two that shouldn't pose any problem. Naturalism can be a worldview as opposed to supernaturalism. And I would expect there is nobody in this room who has a supernatural worldview. I think we are attracted to Lakeside Freethinkers because if we divide now into very distinct categories, because these are quite different from each other, you either believe in something supernatural or you don't. There's really not much middle ground there. So I would be quite shocked if there was anybody in the room who had a worldview based on a belief in supernaturalism. I'm just taking that as a given. But below that, there are subcategories. And this is where I'm going in the naturalism overview. There is a phrase out there, and again, these are not precise terms because so many terms in the English language are not precise, but we kind of get the sense of what they mean. There is a worldview based on scientific naturalism, an emphasis on science, and there is a worldview described as spiritual naturalism. Okay, so that one is where I'm going this evening. And the point I want to make is to be extremely clear that spiritual naturalism leaves no room for the supernatural. They reject the supernatural, but embrace spirituality, as opposed to scientific naturalism, who also reject supernaturalism, but do not embrace spirituality.
I would argue already. Because I put myself in both those worlds, scientific naturalism, and I'm assuming I know what you mean by spiritual naturalism. And I'm hoping you'll define spiritual the way you mean it.
I'll define it the way people who use the term organizationally rather than my personal is not important. But I didn't quite get your comment.
You might have seen some of the discussions that Ken Crosby and I have had on the subject of spirituality. And I think there is such a thing as secular spirituality, mm-hmm. and it doesn't involve supernaturalism at all. It's just a sense of connection with the universe, an attitude of mystery, awe, gratitude, connectivity. It's a feeling you get when you go out in the night sky and look up the Milky Way, and you understand what you're experiencing, and you are raptured.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way he's using this.
Yeah, and I think I might even have been part of some of those discussions. And I think that captures, for those people who know Ken Crosby, and I don't mean this to disparage him at all, but I would say Ken personifies quite well a scientific naturalist worldview. And you don't, so therefore...
I think I do.
Well, you're pretty open to spiritual naturalism.
But I think I belong in both.
These are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
These are not mutually exclusive. And
are you saying that these things experientially exist? You experience them, but science is not yet explained. It's something you feel, but it has not yet been explained.
For a lot of people, yes. The spiritual is very much the emotional side of life as opposed to the intellectual side of life. That is an element of it. But a point I want to make just on these two categories again, and some of the discussions between the groups are really quite interesting. Spiritual naturalism does not reject scientific naturalism. Okay? It does not reject it. The view of spiritual naturalism is that the scientific naturalism worldview is incomplete. There is nothing wrong with it, but it is viewed as being incomplete. The view from the spiritual the scientific naturalism folks tends to be that the very concept of spiritual naturalism is a meaningless concept. That's the divide between the two groups. Questions on that? That sort of half clear? Okay.
Do they accept that in the future what is spiritual today might be scientific tomorrow?
Yes.
You don't.
A very important aspect of spiritual naturalism is to embrace fully proven science and to do nothing that is contrary to established science.
So science knows it doesn't know everything, right?
A lot of science knows,
science was
but, well, that's, there
still
are people who...
still working on it, aren't they?
Which definition of spiritual are you using?
I will elaborate on that because you're about the fifth person to... spiritual is one of those terms that is not precise. So it has many, many meanings. And it means different things to different people. It's a convenient term under which there are a number of... it's like an umbrella, and there's a number of concepts. And out of those concepts, some people emphasize certain ones, and some emphasize other ones, and it makes them look very different. So... we could spend the whole evening on talking about what is spirituality, and pretty much everybody has their own definition depending on which aspects they emphasize. The spiritual naturalist, I'm going to start talking about specific organizations because when you get it to an organizational level, organizations need more precise definitions. So there is an organization that I'll talk about in a minute, but I want to talk first about an organization called it's a website and it has a name, naturalism.org. Is anybody familiar with that and the organization? It is launched and operated by an individual by the name of Tom Clark. It is one of the best sites on naturalism, and Tom Clark is also somebody, he thoroughly understands scientific naturalism, but he embraces spiritual naturalism. So his website talks about both scientific naturalism and spiritual naturalism, and a very, very good site. So that is one site where he defines spirituality. I personally don't completely line up with his definition, but he needs, you know, he talks about it in his organization, and
does he have a short definition?
He has two paragraphs, which, you know, I don't know, is it helpful if I read
sure.
two paragraphs? Okay, so this is from the website naturalism.org under their heading Spirituality. While the words spiritual and spirituality have supernatural connotations for many, they are widely used to refer to the domain of ultimate existential concerns that engage us all eventually. Our approach to these concerns need have nothing to do with the supernatural. Instead, the realization that human beings and their emotions, thoughts, desires, and actions are empirically at one with the universe can ground a naturalistic, non-dualist spirituality, one that generates wonder, compassion, gratitude, and acceptance. Spirituality can thus be naturalized, and a naturalistic vision of ourselves and the world can inspire and inform spiritual experience. Naturalism understands such experience as psychological states constituted by the activity of our brains, but this doesn't lessen the appeal of such experience or render it less profound. Appreciating the fact of our complete inclusion in nature can generate feelings of connection and meaning that rival those offered by traditional religions, and those feelings reflect the empirical reality of our being at home in the cosmos. So that is how Tom Clark summarizes the concept of spirituality.
Would you say that's different than the definition I just gave?
Pretty close alignment.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's pretty close alignment. Yeah. But in contrast, Sam Harris, I would assume a lot of people here would be familiar with Sam Harris. Sam Harris, in his book, gives his definition of spirituality, which is quite different than this. From Sam Harris, who's a prominent atheist, so, you know, we're talking a very prominent atheist, he puts emphasis on puncturing the illusion of the self. Okay, he is deep into Buddhism, and he's deep into cognitive science, but that's his definition of spirituality. And that is a definition that you will see often in the secular world. This is, people who are very open to psychotic experiences through drugs, which Sam Harris is, as a route into deep meditation, 10-day silent retreats. That the way Sam Harris defines spirituality takes you in a very different direction. So there's a.
I just want to point out that in the definition you just gave, I don't think there's anything in there that can't be done by a machine.
That is a very interesting discussion.
Someday, I mean, we're not there yet. Eventually, a machine will be able to generate states that will simulate, that actually be just identical to what you have described.
I would find that a fascinating topic for this room, and that would probably be enough to bring me to another meeting. Will machines develop the capacity for subjective experience?
No, the machine itself.
Yeah. We'll park that. That's a fascinating topic, but I think we should park that.
Yeah.
But if it comes back, I'd participate.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm next going to talk about an organization that brings right in their name the words together, and that is the Spiritual Naturalist Society. A fairly new organization, launched about 5 years ago, and they bring together the naturalist view and a very robust view of spirituality. I'm going to talk about some of the names on their advisory board, because I think that will tell us quite a bit. Some of these names may resonate here. Tom Clark is on their board, so I've talked about him already. Susan Blackmore, philosopher out of the UK. Nobody in this room knows Susan Blackmore. Oh, you've heard of her? She's an atheist, fascinating character, because her intent as a young woman and an academic, when she was pursuing, I think it was her PhD, she set out to prove the validity of paranormal experience. The end result of that process was that she embraced atheism. But she was serious. She was a believer in it, and did research and tried and tried and tried to find it, couldn't find it, and thought she was failing as a person. Her story is fascinating.
Is she a baroness?
I'm not aware of that.
There was a talk given about some woman, I thought that was her, at an Australian convention on consciousness.
Well, she is often at those kind of conferences, yeah. But she's a philosopher out of the UK,
yeah.
Published author. But she is she's on the advisory board. Stephen Batchelor.
What's her name again?
Susan Blackmore. Anybody know Stephen Batchelor? Yes, I thought you would. He is a prominent secular Buddhist. His best-selling author, Buddhism Without Beliefs, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, are a couple of his books. So he's on the advisory board. I won't mention all of the names. Some of them.
Buddhism without
Buddhism without beliefs.
Thank you.
Yes, Stephen Batchelor. Owen Flanagan, another philosopher, doesn't resonate. Jennifer Hancock, prominent humanist. No. Ted Messner is the executive director of the Secular Buddhist Association. And Rick Heller, another prominent humanist. So the Spiritual Naturalist Society have put together an advisory board with a cross-section of views, but all people that are comfortable under this umbrella of spiritual naturalism.
I might point out that the founder of that organization is identified as a Reverend Daniel Stain.
Strange.
He's the executive director.
Yes.
And the founder.
Reverend of what?
I think he came out of the Unitarian Universalist Unitarian area.
I believe he was, when he was still a religious believer, was a reverend, was a minister.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I don't know why, he has chosen to retain the title. I'm curious why he does that. I think I know, but I'm speculating, because one of the things the Spiritual Naturalist Society is trying to do is lessen the gaps and find common ground with people with different worldviews. There is a tiny, tiny, tiny community of Christian naturalists. I don't get it, but they exist. There are Jewish naturalists, and very much part of the approach of the Spiritual Naturalist Society is to minimize the differences and bring people together in the areas where they share interests. So, but yeah, I've why he uses that title.
He's a reverend in the Bill Maher Church of Weed.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
or the Church of the Good Earth, or the Spaghetti Monster.
No, I think he was a church pastor one time. He was a minister in some, I don't know his religious background. But today he's an atheist. And they're based out of Houston, which I find kind of interesting.
You find that interesting? He's from Texas.
You're from Texas?
Yes.
It's just that, you know.
It took him a while to there was a sense of reluctance.
I find it interesting.
If you were here 5 years ago, you would have heard my initial talk. I think it was the initial meeting of the group, if I'm not mistaken, or the second meeting, perhaps. My talk on having been raised fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. So, in Texas.
Yes. That I get in Texas. Spiritual naturalism, headquartered in Houston, I find odd. Please, I just find it odd. Oregon, I, yeah.
Well, the Atheist Experience comes out of Austin, the TV show.
Austin, right.
Austin. Wait, what is it?
A show called The Atheist Experience, have you ever seen it?
No.
Well, it's pretty popular and very good, but it comes out of Austin.
Out of Austin.
Yeah, which
yeah. I'm going to now talk a little bit from the perspective of the Spiritual Naturalist Society specifically, and they appear to be the most prominent organization in the U.S. On this initiative, although, like I say, they're quite new. And different aspects, they cast a very wide umbrella, and different aspects, even under their very wide umbrella, will resonate differently with different people. I want to zero in on a couple of things that they zero in on in regards to the intentions. What is this organization trying to do? What are the people who are attracted to it trying to do? And there's many things. I'm only going to talk about two of them, but they're two of the big ones. We would probably all agree that the world has a lot of problems. I don't think it's too much. We could debate, it would be an interesting debate actually, is the world making progress or has progress stalled? That's a topic for discussion.
Since the last election, you mean?
I wasn't going to be quite that blunt about it, but it isn't just that. To give some context to what Chad has said, there are a number of there's a rise of nationalism in the world. There are countries like Poland and Hungary where there's some things happening that people would argue this is not progress. There was the Brexit decision in the UK. In the last 5 years, there's been enough things happen that are causing people who have believed in progress to pause and say, are we still, as a world, as societies, making progress? It's a fascinating debate. And people are all over the map. People thought we went to hell in a handbasket in the 60s, and some people are convinced, no, it's really happening today. You know, we are on the verge of the collapse of civilization, if you listen to some people. Yeah.
You have to distinguish between, well, first of all, a definition of progress, but natural progress, meaning the state of the world, ex-humanity, versus what humanity is doing with itself and with the world itself.
Yeah. It quickly becomes complex because you have to agree on a definition of progress, and that's very hard to get agreement on. Yeah.
I think you'll find the behavioral pattern of humanity is cyclical. And if you look at the centuries of each century, you'll find the same cycles going all the way back, such as the 1860s. When we had social revolution throughout the monarchies in Japan, it's a controlled kind of country to look at throughout the shoguns. We have the 1960s. But the 50s of each century is what we call the fulcrum point between the first and the beginning, the quiet years, the silent years. And you can go back centuries and centuries. And I've always studied this cycle. And we're not progressing. We're just repeating this cycle. And we look right now as what's happening, and you just go back to the Industrial Revolution and the Technological Revolution, you'll find the same patterns. But if you trace the economics of things from the very beginning, you'll see that that's the basis for this cycle.
So, yeah, some interesting thoughts.
It's a long, long.
So,
but right now we're doing our very, very best to turn our planet into Venus.
She's beautiful.
What do you mean, huh?
Yeah.
We won't stir up our friend John here, but you can make a strong argument that we're going to fry in the next 100 years. So, I mean, you can't just dismiss that.
But there will always be some kind of life left to regenerate.
Not on Venus.
No. You've been there?
We've sent probes. Yes. There's nobody living there.
Nobody living here.
Yes, but microbes will probably survive.
Not on Venus.
Not on Venus? No microbes?
You can melt lead on the surface.
It's about 800 degrees, isn't it?
Yeah, there's nothing there.
Yeah, well, it's getting hot here, too.
All right, back to spiritual naturalism. There is a strong emphasis on flourishing, well-being, both as individuals and in the societies that we live in. Becoming wiser, making the world better, having better lives ourselves is a big part of it. So an emphasis on both personal transformation and societal transformation with the intent of making lives better. And I'll maybe elaborate a little bit. They got a good schematic on some of the dimensions that they zero in on. They focus in on a transformation in three broad categories. What drives us, does anybody here, does the name Robert Wright?
Yeah.
Robert Wright? No.
No.
No, not the political guy. Robert Wright. Robert Wright is an evolutionary biologist, also an atheist. There's some interesting work on human beings being an animal and what that means and how that plays out in behavior and this animal, this human being, having developed a mind which can now control some of those instinctive behaviors. There's Robert Wright is one of the leading areas in that. He's just published a very controversial book. He's not a Buddhist, but the title of his book is Why Buddhism is True. I haven't read it yet. It's just caused quite a bit of chatter out there. But he comes at these things very much from a scientific perspective as an evolutionary biologist. So we don't behave like a lot of animals because we have minds that we can use, that we can create institutions in society that control what otherwise might be animalistic type behavior. So there is that area of what drives our behavior and understanding and modifying that. What perspective we have. I won't go too far for that. A big area is the area of values. Again, the thinking being that science can talk about facts, but science, properly understood, cannot define values. Can inform values, the facts play out very importantly, but making that fact-value distinction and putting a lot of emphasis then on the values that we have, both as individuals and in the societies that we live in. So generally, the big umbrella is transformation, personal and societal. The second is transcendence, which is a word that often people react to with, oh, we're starting to get into things supernatural. No, not as the term is used by the spiritual naturalist community. So the idea is simply that we have a desire as human beings to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And what is that? And for some then it becomes, you get into this concept, not one that I personally identify with very much, but I think I can grasp it, is the idea that nature is sacred. Nature is the most important thing there is. So we elevate it and deem it to be, not because there's anything supernatural going on in the universe, it's just that it's that important. So there are secular people who really talk about this concept of nature is sacred, that resonates with a certain group of people.
By sacred, you mean?
Well, sacred is another one of those words. What Jay Forrest means when he uses the word sacred is that which is most important. So a religious person would say nothing is more important than God. He rejects that. And he says, no, what is most important is nature, the natural world. And it's important to the point that we elevate, put it up on a pedestal and spend time and energy. Some people...
More important than...
Well, Jay Forrest will say, if you... More important than anything. For him, nature is the most important thing.
So nature is defined as life on the planet or
the whole
nature,
natural world,
which includes the universe.
Yes,
which includes everything. So
yes.
When you say it's most important, I was just wondering what the more important than than what?
I would refer you to Jay Forrest. I'm not big into this myself, but there are secular people who quote worship nature.
Earth first,
yes.
Radical group Earth is first. There must be natural.
There has to be some kind of separation when you just say everything, including the universe, is nature. That doesn't make sense. You know, I think you have to come down to whether it's the earth, whether it's humans on the earth, and things like that. But for me, with the word sacred is difficult. But it places like sacred ground above all values, all over anything else. So highest than value.
It's one of those words that has a literal meaning in religion.
It's
being used metaphorically outside of religion.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
You also use the word worship.
In
religion, then that's a specific activity.
Yes.
But when you say, do you worship money, that's a metaphorical use.
Well, yes, but there are people in the secular community who worship, almost in a religious sense, nature. Not big, but it is out there.
What are they doing?
They have. I'm not sure. I've never been involved with them. But they have ceremonies.
Druids, for instance.
So rituals.
Rituals. Yeah.
Native Americans. Native Americans as a people.
But once you use the word ritual, then you have parameters to it. My feeling about that is then coming into the field of religion or nature or religious nature. I would not use the word ritual. For a rain dance or anything else, that's still, to me, some kind of parameter of religion.
Yes, but there is an intent here. I think Stephen is making an interesting point. There is an intent, as near as I can determine, some of these people in the spiritual naturalist community want to remove from the religious community the exclusive ownership of some of these concepts. That's what's going on here.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. They don't own morality. They don't own spirituality.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So the use of the words is deliberate, whereas other people freak if you're a scientist and you use the word spiritual, there's something wrong with you as a scientist. There's that flavor of thought as well. These people are responding partly to those people in the community who reject spirituality and claim it is a meaningless concept. So that's one of the divides on the secular side. It's all very interesting. A second area is community. Again, committing ourselves to something bigger than ourselves. Anytime you're part of a group, you begin to elevate your interest beyond your own personal interest. So there is a strong activist element. People who see social activism, pursuing social justice, that's part of the spiritual natural community as well. So again, different people emphasize different things. Environment might resonate with some, community building resonate with others. Where it gets interesting and philosophical, and I won't go very far because I don't know very much, is transcending the self. which again, some people, like Sam Harris, is big on that. That is a big part of secular spirituality. And some of those debates are almost impossible to understand. It's very big in secular Buddhism that the extinguishing the self or the illusion of the self, and therefore transcending what we would otherwise be as human beings. I find the discussion fascinating. I have never had such an experience, so I can't relate to it. But I believe Sam Harris. I mean, to me, he's a credible individual, and many others like him. I mean, if it was one or two, there are thousands that claim, and we would see that as a psychological state. But they say, well, yes, it is a psychological state, but it's a particular type of psychological state that is life-changing. That's the significance of it. Final point that I want to make. There is a group in the UK called the Middle Way Society, which is the closest thing that I can find outside of the United States somewhat on the same track. So this particular individual is, his name is Robert Ellis, published a number of books, started a society, also quite new, I think last 5-6 years.
What's his name, please?
Robert M. Ellis, E-L-L-I-S, Middle Way Society out of the UK. So that is the presentation that I had for you this evening. The rest is detail.
Well, thank you. That was stimulating.
Yeah.
Sure, the discussion.
What is the significance, or what's the difference or distinction in the Middle Way Society? You're saying this is another spiritual naturalism group.
The underlying philosophy is slightly different. Where Robert Ellis comes from is the rejection of all dogma and all absolutes. So let me illustrate that with the concept, does God exist? The position of Robert Ellis is that we cannot be certain that God exists, nor can we be certain that he does not exist. And he takes that approach to many different topics. It's essentially the driving force there is a rejection of all dogma. And finding what he calls the messy middle. Rather than being pulled to one extreme or the other, we live in this messy middle where we cannot have certainty, so let's learn to embrace uncertainty and live the best we can.
Good attitude.
Making
a choice of guessing one way or the other when you don't have enough information is not a good thing to do.
Yeah, but he takes that far further than most. Yeah.
Well, I think the question is why do I have to choose? You know, the idea of choice sometimes is irrelevant. Choosing boxes the mentality in. So the choice, if somebody says, do you believe in God, then hey, whether he exists or doesn't exist is not, to me, provable, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an educated position, though. I think that instinct is naturally to just make a choice, and you have to learn to resist doing that.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
Right.
And that's, I think, the problem with most of humanity, is they make these choices, and then they put themselves in that choice.
Well, I don't know what's the right answer. Well, I don't know is the right answer. That's the answer you should get.
There's the probability that all the gas molecules will throw this thing to the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
It's non-zero. But I'm going to bet that it's going to stay right there.
Right. Well, why do you say that now? Why do you say that now?
Because there is a non-zero probability.
But how does that relate to it?
Well, it's because it's all probability. What you're saying is, You shouldn't bet on that the glass is going to stay here.
I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. You said it's non-zero probability. You shouldn't make a decision.
Did you hear that phrase?
But I just heard that.
You heard me say non-zero probability?
You said if you can't know for sure, then you shouldn't bet on it. And I'm saying you can't know for sure.
No, I said you shouldn't decide.
You should decide that the glass is going to stay on the table. I'm saying,
oh boy, he doesn't care.
But that's just a probability of something that's known. Uh-huh. It's different from a probability of something that's not known.
But you see,
unknown.
This counteracts the concept of not making a choice, however, counteracts concepts of society. Because without making a choice, there's total chaos. So, unfortunately, it devolves into politics, where the choices are so hard and fast that it makes it impossible to come back from that position to say, well, there is a good way to do it. The classic example I give is, it's my right to drive straight down the street. And it's Bobby's right to drive straight down the street. But she's impinging upon my right if she does. But to avoid a crash, we agree upon a societal thing such as a stop sign or a red light or something like that.
Or lanes.
So you have to make... You have to make some kind of a choice.
Well, maybe I misunderstood. You often make choices with incomplete knowledge. I'm not saying otherwise. I'm just saying if you don't know the answer, don't say yes, it's this, or no, it's that. If you don't know, you don't know.
I agree
with
that.
You sometimes have to choose anyway.
Well, I agree with that, but I say, but just for societal value, in essence, to prevent total chaos, you have to make some choices.
Well, there's no.
And probably in the absence of knowing which is right and which is wrong.
Actually, there's no such thing as chaos. You just don't see the pattern. And in society, using the word society creates a pattern. So you're talking about the pattern of society, whereas Stephen and I are talking about choices of things that are unknown, like the existence of God, or other kinds of things, or the choice of what's going to happen in the future. Do I have to make this?
It's a spectrum. It's an exposure.
Is it known or unknown that this glass is going to throw itself to the ceiling?
We have very high confidence that it's all just.
I have very high confidence that there's no God.
But if it did, you would know why, and there'd be nothing wrong with that explanation.
And to make it relevant to the discussion, Ellis would reply to you that your high level of confidence that God does not exist is not adequately justified.
I agree. Yeah, how do you say that? How do you know that? All I can say is there's no God that wants me to be known. Because that God I would know. But how do you know that there's not something lurking in the background? I don't know. Well, that's my point. There's no way to calculate that.
But I would say in defense of what he is saying here, that before anyone proposed a concept of God, his position would be the default position.
Right.
It's only when someone comes up with the concept of God that this discussion begins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to me, it gets back to the old, you know, debate about, well, who's, you know, upon who is the burden of proof? You know, you get to that whole circular discussion again. But to me, there's, yes, technically, you can't prove it from a hypothetical proof situation if you're looking at it from a scientific method. You can't prove one way or the other.
You don't have to prove that God does not exist.
Yes.
They have to prove that God does exist.
Right.
But Steve's making the statement that you cannot definitively state that he does not exist, right?
I not only say that, I say there's no way to even estimate a probability for it.
Well, isn't that because the question itself doesn't really mean anything? Because saying God doesn't exist, anything doesn't exist that we don't have.
Well, you're right. You do have to define what you mean by God.
Yeah.
Because there's different meanings for that word, too.
Well, the bottom line also about Susan Blackmore was because she didn't have the experience, therefore she made an opinion that God didn't exist because she didn't have a paranormal experience, which I find makes her more involved with her own self, her own feeling of her condition.
She made an extraordinary effort to prove that the supernatural was real. I mean, she was doing science.
Yes. No, I understand that. Yeah. But that doesn't mean to me that because then she decides he doesn't exist. Because I, like I said, I don't worry about it.
But now we're into her experience cannot become your experience.
No.
But she made a very rational choice based on her experience.
She made a rational, I don't know if I'd call it rational. But
really?
I go beyond that. Whether some people and scientists and whatnot have paranormal experiences, which I don't know, but that does not eliminate their attitude because she decided she didn't have one. Therefore, in her mentality, God doesn't exist.
It has to come down to the person who has it has to prove it to others.
Yeah.
Because you can have any kind of experience you want inside your head, but that doesn't make it real. It makes it real to you, but that doesn't make it real in reality. So you can say, yeah, God's in my head, I'm Jesus, but that doesn't make it true. It only makes it true to you.
That's so psychosis.
Some people call it psychosis, and some people call it I'm God. But for sure,
I call it a waste of time.
It's definitely a waste of time because there's no convincing.
Nothing.
But it becomes important. It becomes important for this reason, and this is one of the things I like about the middle way. It becomes important whether Henry's line of thinking is. Is that his way of thinking is on solid ground. Okay? So you can make the argument that Henry's thinking is on solid ground, but you can also say it is not, and then look at those arguments. And that then reflects our judgment on people who come to a different conclusion. People like Robert Ellis and the Middle Way have gone so far as to say that fundamentally, neither conclusion is on fundamentally solid ground. And everything that flows from that is pretty significant. It allows for the building of bridges, and you either truly believe that. I quite respect Henry's position, but it makes a difference on the ability to bridge gaps between people with very significant different views, because the logical conclusion of Henry's line of thinking is that you cannot believe in God and be rational, which is a dangerous conclusion from the perspective of some people. That is why it is significant. It isn't does God exist or not, that's an important question too, but is it even possible for a human being to rationally believe in the existence of God? That becomes a very important question when you're trying to organize a society.
But as we've seen, it can be rational in all kinds of ways except that one little area. And that's because they were raised as a Christian or whatever. They have that belief that they can't get rid of. But they can be rational in the other ways. I was born an atheist. I become a reborn atheist after my time in the Mormon church. So I'm a reborn atheist. But I was born an atheist.
Right.
I had no beliefs.
Right.
Well, recently, in fact, this afternoon, before I came here, I happened to go on the internet, and they discussed this very thing about what makes people believe in something and why they cannot change their beliefs. It has something to do with a little tiny area in your brain called the amygdala, which is an emotional part of your thinking. And so belief and emotion are in direct relationship to each other. And it's an interesting study, I think. That's why people are so strongly in favor of Brexit. London, because they had a firm emotional belief that it would make their lives better. It wasn't based on fact or science, it was an emotional feeling.
Why people supported Trump.
So, anyway, there's an article.
Well, that's what faith basically means, is unjustified belief. And there's plenty of it around.
You just think.
You know,
I can't believe in something that isn't falsifiable. I just can't. If it's falsifiable, and then it's science. If it's not falsifiable in any way, if you can always find a way around it, it just, I can't believe it.
You say if it's
falsifiable.
Then it is science?
Then
no.
It's science.
Well, yeah.
Well, no statement is scientific if it's not falsifiable. And what they mean by that is if it's wrong, there has to at least be the potential of
showing that it's wrong. If there's no way to show that it's false, it's just...
It's not scientific, but it doesn't make it wrong.
What would an example of that be?
A falsifiable statement would be the sun will not rise tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
I like Richard Dawkins' teapot rotating around the moon.
Yeah.
You can't disprove it, but do we believe it? No.
Right.
Yes.
So the problem with God is there's no falsifiable statement you can make about it. You can't say, well, okay, he's made out of blue things, and well, okay, you find him, he's not made out of blue. Oh, well, he's made out of green things. There's no falsifiable statement that you can make about God. There's nothing that you can say that they can't maneuver around.
Yeah, that's true. And my having gone to live in Japan and also studying in Asia, I was always interested in why the Eastern world couldn't meet the Western world. And standing on the top of Masada, something happened, and I realized what it was. And that we're in the Western world, we're Christianized, and we're also indoctrinated into the idea of threes. In the Eastern world, there's cycles, it's cyclical. And so if you put an Eastern man in a crisis with a Western man, and the crisis happens, the Western man immediately says, oh God, help me. Even if he isn't religious, he'll go outside himself. The Eastern man goes inside himself. And that's why it would never meet. And because you're so indoctrinated, and I do like the Eastern world with this kind of continual cycle is more open than I find it, being a part of the Western world, which I find so, that I've been battling all my life, this indoctrination.
I would say until the Industrial Revolution.
Pardon?
And until the Industrial Revolution, the Western world was completely engrossed in cycles.
Yes. And so.
Yeah, so the Western world was completely engrossed in cycles.
But as far as that cycle, it's still involved in threes, and it's still indoctrination of a religion.
No, I'm talking about pagan.
But, pardon?
Pagan societies, why do we have the Christmas tree? I mean, it's pre-Christian, right? It was because they recognized that they summer had to return in order to get the next year's harvest. They understood cycles very well.
Oh yes, but that's not the kind of cycle I'm talking about. I'm talking about the idea of life in a cyclical pattern in the Eastern world, the idea of reincarnation, and that things come and go in this kind of cycle. And he believes in fives and sevens, and we believe in three. You know, starting from the pyramid and everything in religion, government, we divide into parts of three. Whereas in the Eastern world, it's much more
involved with this cyclical nature, like Shintoism. Is more of a nature-oriented religion, and that kind of cycle is very different. Also, there's no future tense in the language. So with no future tense, and there's no word for no in the polite form of Japanese language, which is very existential and means that everything exists. We can't think that way.
Is that true in all Eastern thinking? Eastern languages, there is no...
I believe that's mostly true, isn't it? Yeah. From what I had to study and learn Japanese and Chinese and whatnot, was it true? So, and having now family who is in Japanese, that it, I'm always fascinated with the way that they deal with death and what's happened. And I can't do that, and I try very hard, because I know that I would never, ever be able to think my mentality in that part of the world, even though you try. Because with a professor that I was studying with, I said to him, Michael, that you should only live in Japan for 3 years, because after that, you'll get the mistaken notion that you understand. Because you can't.
There's your freeze again.
I know. Exactly. You can't get away from it.
Thanks for coming.
I'm going to read a lot of stuff.